You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Pleasure of having Liz Goodman here with us today to talk about walled gardens, which is really fun. Liz is a PhD student at the University of California, Berkeley, at the Information School, my alma mater, which is so super exciting. She has sort of a funny path of a background, having done her master's degree at the Interactive Telecommunication Program at NYU, her undergrad at Yale, and having worked for Intel, doing a whole variety of things on health. But has been all throughout it really interested in how we think about designs. So a lot of the conversation today is going to be talking about different ideas with regard to design and technology.
Thanks to Amar and Dana for setting this up. I'm really pleased to be here. And what I want to do today is share with you something that's not baked yet. It's a new project. It's an extension, really, of work I've been doing with community gardeners. And so what I'm hoping you'll do, I'm told that these are kind of lively and engaged discussions, is engage in this discussion. Talk with me about this, give feedback, talk with each other, and that I'm hoping I'll be able to kind of spark that discussion instead of kind of pronouncing these very firm conclusions that shut it down. And so what I'm going to do here is, you know, as we see, compare the walled gardens that form such an important part of our discussions about various services and products, like, oh, right now the Kindle, for example, or Facebook, or the Apple App Store for the iPhone, and compare those to both the kind of the walled gardens that are imagined in people's heads. You know, what's the original referent of walled garden that comes to mind when I say walled garden? And I want everyone to kind of hold that in their heads. And I'm then going to compare that to experiences of what I might call a contemporary equivalent of the walled garden, which are community gardens that, despite their name, are very often fenced off from the neighborhoods they're located in. So they are quite literally walled in their gardens, and they're internationally popular. So I think that we'll all agree that they're, you know, a really interesting site for engagement and research. And Dana gave you a little bit about me, but I just want to reinforce that by saying that I am not a lawyer, not a policymaker. I come from a design background, and I speak very much from that background. What I'm doing right now, my research for the past few years, has really focused on how emerging technologies help change people's experiences of places, in particular, everyday, ordinary places and cities like coffee shops and parks and street corners. I did, in fact, do healthcare research for a while. One of the products I helped shape is on the market around the world. And I'm continuing to look at design, but also continuing to look at the ways in which the metaphors we use, the kinds of ways we talk about products and services, shape the kinds of possibilities we imagine for them and for how people can act in them. And that's really what this talk is going to be about. So this is just going to summarize the whole talk right now. If you'd like to leave the room, you can go now. And so that's the initial idea, is that walled garden is a kind of commonplace in the sort of original English language term. A commonplace is a shared expression, a common ground that people can use to find a shared set of meanings they can talk about. And walled garden, I think, is valuable because it's common and it's very concrete, it's very tangible. We think we understand what walled gardens are. And we attribute then meaning to the idea of the walled garden through imagination and maybe through experience. So, you know, if you think about the internet, a lot of geographic metaphors are used. I'm not going to go into all the metaphors of cyberspace, but I just told Dana about my favorite, which is the creepy treehouse metaphor for bad educational websites. public park, gated community, et cetera, et cetera. And then what we bring to those metaphors affects what we expect to get out of them. And I'm going to suggest as a starting point that many of us have pretty limited experiences of walled gardens as a horticultural typology. And that then influences how we deploy the digital metaphor. So for example, Doc here asked me about silos. And I thought, well, you know, from my work as a designer and as a researcher, silos have nothing to do with walled gardens. What are you talking about? And then I realized, no, of course, in the world of technology, they do. They seem very close. They both refer to, you know, an enclosed space that's separated from others. So what I'm going to want to do is think about walled gardens as a tool to think with, kind of borrowing from Seymour Papert, and think about how walled gardens could be more useful if we enriched our existing set of associations and assumptions with some empirical investigation into these modern walled gardens. And for those of you like me who like dictionary definitions, this is what the OED has to say about walled gardens. And one of the things I want to point out is that walled garden is a really old phrase. They've been in existence for a long time. And the second use in for digital networks is, as one would expect, much newer. It starts in the 1990s. The first one, the horticultural one, is very positive. Words like fresh air, at ease, warm, splendor. It sounds pretty nice, actually. And the second set of examples start out somewhat ambivalent, vetted but still extensive, basic. And then suddenly you start seeing things like stalled, limited. And that suggests to me that strangely, there's one set of walled gardens of which we have very positive feelings and one set which are ambivalent to negative. And just to be clear here, I just want to make sure that I know all of you guys know what walled gardens are and how they're used. But just to clarify things, here's a kind of unscientific sample of walled gardens and discussion about walled gardens today. The Kindle, the App Store, Facebook, all of those are talked about as walled gardens. Walled gardens colloquially get described as a, quote, lack of openness. There's an idea of boundary crossing made very difficult. And the last one, I think, represents the sort of sprawl or the spread of the walled garden use in that the Macmillan Dictionary, which is a British dictionary, describes a walled garden as a website that you need a username and password to look at things, which, all right, that's a bit more severe than my definition, but it's interesting to note that it kind of comes to be expanded and expanded to include any kind of boundary or division. When people talk about technological walled gardens, they often use pictures of quote-unquote real gardens to illustrate them. And here's a selection also of what I'd call typical typologies of images that are used to illustrate digital walled gardens. So you'll have an article on the Kindle, and it will have this beautiful picture of a Victorian garden illustrating it. Okay? It's not a Kindle, obviously, but it is a walled garden. And the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, which was a delightful surprise to me that when some people think of walled gardens, they go all the way back to, you know, not just pre-modern, but not prehistoric, but certainly they go pretty far back. And one of the things I'd like to point out is that all these gardens that people imagine aren't actually in use as part of what we might call mundane, everyday practices of daily life. We have, again, these ancient hanging gardens. We have this sort of showplace museum, Victorian garden. We have palace gardens, which are in use as public park in Vienna. And they're all very special, calm, beautiful places that are for leisure. They're decorative. And they bear very little resemblance, I think. I'm sorry, I forgot your name. Sarah Cortez said, they bear very little resemblance to what you experience in your Facebook stream. special, calm, beautiful, lovely. No, not so much. You know, the walled gardens that we think of online are often not associated with any of these beautiful images and feelings that the pictures convey. And just an aside, by the by, originally walled gardens were not decorative. The walls were not just decorative, and they were not just meant to keep out the hoi polloi or the uninvited. The walls were there to create a kind of microclimate in which plants could flourish better. They protected plants from the wind. They actually raised the temperature in the garden a little bit. You could set fires inside brick walls to warm gardens, kind of like a greenhouse. And I'm saying this not to give you trivia, but to point out that a historical connection to what walled gardens were can actually help us defamiliarize these very romantic images of beautiful, calm, lush gardens and see them as places of work and production and kind of struggle with the labor of growing plants. And that sometimes the walls are actually there so that the plants can thrive better in a climate that's not particularly forgiving to them. So that's my big question that motivates this new direction for my work, my existing work with community gardeners. And I'm going to cut short any more suspense and tell you that the answer is yes. Yes, yes, I do think it's useful. You are feel free to kind of talk back to me on this one, but I'm going to go forward on this assumption and frame this thinking about digital walled gardens then with the kind of mundane lived walled gardens that I looked at in the Bay Area, which are places like this, which also are very, I should say, beautiful. So for 2 years, I was studied community gardeners and public park volunteers in the Bay Area. And I did so not because I was interested in digital walled gardens, but because I was interested in collective management of shared resources. And I was really interested in how you might design systems to support the kind of shared group management of limited resources that require physical upkeep. So how can we help people share cars? How can we help people share houses? How can we help people share pets, you know, share kids? Sure, why not? You know, it'd be easier to take care of kids if more people did, and they're definitely limited resources. I interviewed community gardeners at 4 gardens, performed participant observation with a park volunteer group, which means that I spent about a year with them on Saturdays, working with them and understanding how they saw the park and how they saw their relationships to each other. But parks and gardens are kind of different. I'll mostly be talking about the gardens here. So here's 2 things that I'd like you to note about this garden. First, it's fenced off. And in order to get in, you have to be a member. You have to apply to be a member. They have to give you a key. So in many ways, this feels kind of like the classic walled garden scenario. Second, it's mostly not collectively cultivated, in the sense that we might think of a community or shared garden being collectively cultivated. This was a bit of an unpleasant surprise for me when I was trying to study collective management, but there you go. Those kind of wooden boxes demarcate individually managed plots of land. It is kind of like MySpace, in the sense that you can have these totally hideously designed little plots of land and do whatever crazy stuff you want to and make terrible, terrible design decisions, and nobody will stop you as long as you don't interfere with any of the other garden members' ability to garden. And as long as you, and this here's where it differs from MySpace, as long as you keep maintaining your garden. So if you abandon it, if you don't show up, if you don't care for it, in these walled gardens, you get kicked out. They take away your key, they take you off the email list, and then you have to reapply to get back in and promise them you'll never do it again. So it's a bit different from all these websites we think of that maybe have dead pages or dead projects. And some gardens in the Bay Area are so oversubscribed, you can wait 2 to 3 years for a spot to get in. They're incredibly desired, some of them. And that also makes them a little different than digital walled gardens, right? The physical limitations of geographic space mean that you can't just infinitely reproduce it. You can't just get another server for a garden. There are some other similarities which I think I'd like you to keep in mind. Plants are less easy to reproduce and copy
than photos of cute cats or whatever, but they do reproduce themselves if left alone, and they do. Community gardens do thrive on cross-fertilization, seed sharing, and plant gifting. So there's actually a lot of work on copying things and moving things around within the garden. And in both the walled gardens and horticultural gardens, unchecked reproduction, let's say, copying things you shouldn't copy too often in ways in which people who run the garden don't like, is seen as a problem that they'd like to shut down. And they both require extensive maintenance. And this is actually where we see a lot of talk about gardening in system administration. So there used to be, it used to be in vogue in the 1990s to talk about sysadmins as gardeners. More recently, the Stanford Social Innovation Review described the role of community organization online as being a lot more like gardening than like landscaping. And you should take that as you will. The author clearly meant a distinction. I think the distinction is clearly in the mind of the author, but it's very important to the author to maintain the distinction between gardening as a good thing and landscaping as a problematic thing. And I think it, but I think it points out the ways in which we kind of hold very tightly to these ideas about what plants and gardens and landscaping is and does. So, how does it actually then work? And I'm just going to keep talking, by the way. So I'd like people to interrupt me if you'd like to. I know I talk fast. Raise a hand and I'll stop talking. But, okay, no one says anything. We'll move on. Yes, I see a hand. Good.
I certainly could wait on this. I'm not sure whether your invitation was... whether you'd rather continue, in which case I'll...
No. Bring it up now, and then if I feel like I was going to answer it on the next slide, I'll say, hey, wait. But if it's a...
One of the people who independently came up with the notion of gardening for managing, and one of them was a woman named Adina Levin at Social Text, which was creating enterprise widgets. Wikis for business. And... she made this point, and people said, oh, yeah, that's a very good point. We should start talking about it as gardening, and, which is became the metaphor that Social Text uses. But it seemed fairly clear to me in the context of the discussion that she, as opposed to maintenance and management, she was suggesting gardening. And I think one of the reasons why people nodded and said yes was that there was an unstated implication of femininity versus masculinity in this section. Which I sort of am bringing to the gardening versus, I'm trying to figure out the gardening landscaping thing also. Yeah. That one's industrial and heavy equipment and sort of, you know, prototypically male-ish. Is that right? Am I investing this with gender, or is this a part of the gardening, rise of the gardening metaphor for interior maintenance?
That's a really good question. And my feeling is that the walled garden metaphor as a kind of noun, right, as a concrete entity in the world, does not necessarily have gendered overtones. It's, in fact, kind of very, it's a very, what's the word, depersonalized vision. It's a garden. Gardening with the gardener. I didn't follow that particular discussion, but my tendency is to nod and say, yes, I believe you. Because there are a lot of gendered overtones in terms of caring, nurturing, you know, the kind of verbs we use to think about gardeners oftentimes really reflect assumptions about who the gardener is. Are gardeners like mothers? Are we talking about Mother Earth? I see another hand.
An interesting distinction between gardeners and farmers.
Mm-hmm. And that's one that actually my research participants really made. They described themselves as gardeners, not farmers, with the implied kind of ontological distinction that a farm is an industry, it's a business, it's profit-centered, not necessarily a bad thing, but that they were in the gardening, they were doing gardening for personal improvement, that for them it was kind of individual, it was much more about these relationships of caring, nurturing, skill, craft, I could go on, authentic relationships to the land. And so they kept in their heads some pretty clear distinctions, maybe a bit like the gardening landscaping distinction.
Although there's actually a continuum there, right? Landscape, if you take landscape, garden, and farm, where landscape in many ways I think of as for production of image and look, mm-hmm. gardening for a whole variety of personal enjoyment, and farming for real hardcore production.
That's a totally reasonable personal kind of spectrum or set of distinctions to make. One of the things that I find really interesting about these, sort of again moving between how we talk about digital spaces and how we talk about physical spaces, is that when you start pushing on people, the personal sets of categories they produce are very diverse. And where we might assume some commonality, we should probably actually instead assume a kind of diversity of background. Landscapers, for example, might see themselves, if people who identify themselves as landscapers may see what they do as gardening too, or gardening as the creation of landscapes. I don't want to get too into it, but there's actually a really interesting tangle here. First.
I live in a neighborhood with lots of walled gardens, and I actually worked on a case that had a walled garden, and I never much thought about the analogy between them, but it seems like they're exactly the opposite. All the walled gardens in my neighborhood are about keeping people out, mm-hmm. and the walled garden in the case I worked about was about keeping the people who were in it from escaping. It was a digital walled garden, you know, until you signed up and gave your credit card. So they seemed very different. You know, the analogy doesn't work at all in that case. And I just had accepted.
The question is it about the people or is it about the content? And is it about the content of, like, for example, the plants have to stay in the walled garden just like the content?
But the walls existed, in Beacon Hill, the walls exist to keep the people on the outside from coming in.
Right.
And the walls in the digital walled garden were about keeping the people who were in it from getting out. It wasn't about the content at all.
I think it's also a prior question, you know, which is the broader social context, like population density. And when you started talking about walled gardens, I started thinking of Algerian cities and Moroccan cities and cities that are very, very dense. And you look at something and you think it's just a wall. And then, in fact, behind it, I mean, and so you start with a courtyard rather than a garden, but then gardens grow within it and all that. So there's a whole set of incredible questions there, I think.
Sorry, let's skip back.
Okay.
Just around you.
You may want to go on. I may be, you know, interrupting what you're doing, but the one place where I'm finding the analogy doesn't work for me, at least not yet, is that when I think of, you know, the kind of enterprise you just showed me, the community garden with all the little individual plots, if you're part of that, you're part, even though it's divided up into little individual plots, you're still part of some sort of collective, cooperative enterprise, and you're basically buying into the joint management of an operation with a small number of other people. I would guess there's probably not more than 200 gardens in a place like that. It wouldn't be manageable if it was much bigger than that. Whereas the way I usually hear the term walled garden used in the, you know, internet world doesn't have any of those implications that you are a sort of co-equal partner with all the other people in the walled garden, and that you're involved with managing it and keeping it in good repair. Using a walled garden in the digital seems to me to be, you know, something that somebody else runs, and you're not really part of keeping it going. You're just, you know, getting an admission ticket to it.
So I have two thoughts about that. One is that I'm not trying to say, I want to make it clear, that the analogy needs to match, that they need to be the same. In fact, in some ways, I think it's more interesting if there's some kind of productive friction between them, because I'm hoping that we can change the way we think about digital walled gardens in response to, you know, to my mind, sort of the much more interesting stuff happening on the ground. The second thought is, I think you've actually pointed to something that, yet another surprise to me about community gardens, is that there's often not a lot of what we would idealize as community there. You know, Voltaire wrote, you have to cultivate your own garden, and thus, for example, this garden here is, can only loosely be called a collective enterprise. You know, kind of like a lot of those online spaces or projects we've known where one or two people put in, you know, 99% of the labor and the rest kind of do what they have to do when they're sort of coerced into it. You know, this garden has a couple people who really feel the garden as a collective enterprise, and then a lot of people who do what they have to do to not get kicked out, but don't feel any particular, you know, we think of a community, we think of some place with a shared past and a shared future and perhaps some values in common. And they have essentially a walled-off geographic space in common with maybe a shared interest in not letting boll weevils get in. It's actually a lot less communitarian than I had thought of. And there's a geographer named, if you're interested, Mary Beth Putup, who's done some great work on community gardens. She calls them organized gardening projects in order to help us kind of step back from our beliefs in community and in kind of implanting them in gardens where it may not actually be happening. So I actually see a lot of these gardens as maybe being a bit more like Facebook or, you know, a bit more like other places where there's some, where individuals make relationships, but someone who has a page on Facebook doesn't necessarily feel committed to the continuing health and security of the network as a whole.
I was just going to mention that the first reference I heard to, you know, this idea of walled garden and the internet was to AOL back in the 90s.
Yes.
There, it seemed to make sense according to the sorts of things that you're describing, where, you know, you're not thinking of the whole internet or even something like Facebook, which is a little more customized, specialized within social networks, but that you people do create, you know, discussion forums and sort of a common sense of, okay, all the people in AOL can have these special prearranged structures and easy to use applications and so on within AOL, and they don't want you to obviously go and get your access from someplace else. So they want to keep you there, but they like to make it warm and fuzzy and fun. You know, so
I never... that actually, I think the AOL walled garden in some ways has that kind of, I think you're right. It feels more like the way in which we think of walled gardens as being these happy, warm, cozy flower beds. Safe, yes. Oh, don't forget, safe flower beds.
It's interesting that the Oxford definition was from 1995, which seems late to me, but it refers to John Malone, who at that time ran a cable company. Mm-hmm. And AOL was an ideal at that time, actually, mm-hmm. still, that if you wanted to run a business, you had to trap your customers. You had to be, you know, the VCs would all ask, what's your lock-in, right? Mm-hmm. That was, it just kind of went with the territory, you know, what's your lock-in?
I would raise the issue again. We keep going back to it being about customers or people being locked into these things. Mm-hmm. I actually think it's people's attention. I think it's the people's mm-hmm. content. I think it's the people's desire to put time and energy into it. I don't think it's the people themselves, and I think that's where we get into the question of the digital and the physical being this. The people were moving between different yeah. places, but the thing is that where they were having the tension, where their social interactions were occurring, where that was what they was trying to actually contain.
Yeah, but there's this interesting bargain that gets made, though. So, in other words, I, you know, like I upload a zillion pictures to Flickr, and I like Flickr because it's actually rather open. I mean, it's basically a walled garden or a silo with lots of pipes coming in and out of it. I can move my data in and out of it. Does it a better job of presenting it, and it handles tagging well and stuff like that. But I don't have the feeling that they want to trap me, but yet it is still a contained space of some sort. And so we make these, you know, is the bargain I'm making with them a Faustian one or not? I think in some cases with the Facebook, there is that. I think there is that with MySpace to some degree. But I don't know, and it may be at the beginning it's not, and then later it is. You know, Rupert Murdoch could shut down MySpace tomorrow. What happens to it?
I think any time you put some time and energy and commitment into one thing, you're not going to get into other things, and you have you then have more of a responsibility for that place, you have more of a stake in it, and you're going to want to contribute to it more. So if you put everything, if you have like a huge library of stuff that you put on Flickr, even if something better comes around, you're may want to stay. I don't know that that's a wall. I wouldn't call it necessarily a Faustian bargain. You know, it's just the time is finite. The one piece I thought might be an interesting, slightly different discussion is these community gardens in the city. One thing that's very different than a traditional walled garden of the really closed-in type is that people really like to live near a community garden. You know, if you live in a really dense part of the city and then someone takes an empty lot and turns it into a garden, even if you are not part of it, it's a big benefit to you. And I think that is also an interesting way of thinking about how some of these are distinct from others, that some of these walls are impermeable, and they're meant to just really keep people out in every way. But these community gardens are good for the non-participating neighbors. And to what extent where are the online examples of something that's a closed community that provides a benefit to a larger space?
And that's actually sort of my hope, and thank you for in bringing this up, is that it's a great question to ask, because that, you know, you can see that fence right there, if we're going to get very concrete, it's kind of a fence, right?
I think that's a little bit what Doc was saying about Flickr and its openness, is you can never contribute to Flickr, but you can look through things, and, you know, that it does it provides a service for people who really build stuff up in it. People can be totally private, but enough people use it publicly that it's a benefit to a larger world.
And in fact, like Flickr, there are, you know, you can get your photos, like a garden. I mean, you can get plants in and out of a garden. It's not as easy as, you know, just scattering skis all over the place, but you can do it, and people do. And as Dana said, the people go in and out. The plants are a little harder to get in and out. One of the things that was interesting when I talked to gardeners about what they care, like, where's the garden? Where's the relationship located? It turns out that it's located for many people in the soil. It's located in the thing they can't really remove. And that is the sort of main source of cultivation, is this intensive investment in something that doesn't look particularly remarkable. I wonder sometimes if sort of the easiness of reproducibility of digital files gives us this illusion that the time and effort and love and investment that we put into spaces can also be reproduced, that we can sort of find that same relationship elsewhere. So
I'm just curious, what are the people doing in these gardens? Are they just making, are they putting in flowers? Are they doing agriculture? Are they feeding their families? Are they obsessing about something? What's the range there? I mean, I see some that are, that last picture that you were at.
Yeah, the flowers.
I mean, those are flowers. In this case, you've got, it looks to me, yeah, that's all flowers. Do those flowers leave? What happens? I'm just curious to know why people do it, right?
That's a really good question. And as it turns out, it's hard to generalize about what's grown in them and the expertise range. People grow flowers, they grow vegetables. Some people really do enjoy the idea of feeding their family. Other people find it immoral to try and grow their own vegetables when there are family farms they could be supporting, and so they grow other things. This guy, whose photo, I love photos of his garden, because he's a master dahlia grower. He wins prizes, and this is a social performance of his expertise. He loves flowers, he gives them to people, he likes to take photos of them. You'll note that they're kind of next to the fence so that people can look at them. You know, when I came to see him, he insisted that I take a giant bouquet. And that's a somewhat different world than this garden, which is actually doesn't have walls that you can see, where it's kind of random. You know, it's a little all mixed up. There's a little bit of beans, and there's a little bit of corn, there's a little bit of flowers because people think it's pretty. There's a little bit of, you know, just as in people's clothing or their homes, there's a lot of different ways of ordering these places.
The Grace Marchand Gardens.
The what?
The Grace Marchand Gardens. It's by under Coit Tower.
I've never been there.
Oh, just check it out. It's this old lady, who's like 100-some years old, tended this garden all by herself and then died, and then the community took it over. And it was going to be, the city was going to buy it or pave it or something like that. And there was a break, this is back in the 80s, there was a protest about it.
I mean, something, a kind of categorization that's been useful to me in thinking about garden work and maybe about spaces online and how people feel about them and what the walls mean, the gardens for, is that many of the gardens I looked at were really about individual improvement, about being happier, about feeling healthier, about having a hobby, being skilled, essentially really personal motivations. And this garden was an example of a different garden. As I said, it's in a low-income neighborhood in San Francisco. And the residents got together to make this garden because they were tired of drug dealers sitting in this abandoned median, and they wanted to kind of physically displace them. And the way they chose to physically displace the drug dealers was through occupying the space, putting time in with their bodies, and continuously cultivating it. And in a sense,
that the garden is the wall.
The garden is the wall, exactly. You know, so here you don't see any walls, but that doesn't mean that they're not there. And that's an example of what you might call kind of an external, a real community or a collective effort in which there was a shared goal, a shared future, a shared kind of imagined purpose for everybody in that garden. And in fact, again, it doesn't look like there are walls or individual plots, but there is someone who runs the garden. She's in her 70s. She's lived in the neighborhood forever. And I can't imagine what would happen to you if you tried to plant something in that median without her permission. It's just unthinkable. And so once again, you have these relationships between people that really create boundaries about who can enter and exit, even when the walls themselves don't seem to be there. I mean, I think it gets to this point about both online and offline kind of groups, which is that some of the walls seem very clearly instantiated in technical decisions, like fences or import and export functionality, and some of them are instantiated in kind of enacted relationships between people. I'm not going to go post on 4chan. I'm just not. It's not going to go well for me in some of those forums. And I don't want to say that those are the same kinds of walls, but I think enclosures can be enacted in different ways.
I was actually thinking 4chan as an example, because it's really a barrier of participation. If you want to be an occasional participant, that means you're not part of the community. This also works in forum culture more generally, you know, where you can see the sum of someone's activity, and if they haven't contributed a certain extent, you know, you disregard their contribution to a thread. And so in the same way that you have the walled gardens that require a certain amount of participation every time to keep coming back and using it, like I was seeing that as a non-physical barrier to being part of the space and the community.
In fact, one of the reasons why I'd gotten interested in this is that there are a lot of people who might like to have a garden, and there are lots of reasons why community gardens are great in highly dense cities. There's a lot of pretty real documented health benefits for having more green space in cities. There are kind of larger things that you might like to encourage, but it's pretty hard. You know, people's parents get sick. They have kids. They have jobs. Then their participation in the garden decreases. The garden falls into disrepair. Their plot falls into disrepair. They get kicked out. And that seems like a real unnecessary, let's say, loss to them and lost to their neighborhood. And when that happens to an entire garden, then, you know, essentially what was an empty lot goes back to being an empty lot if you don't take care of them. You know, can we get back to the gardening as, you know, wiki caring membership? It just kind of becomes overgrown. And so my hope had been to design strategies to kind of help people do that work together. Sorry, go on.
So there's been a pretty lively and interesting discussion on the back channel. Back channel discussion is always interesting. It's not always on point, but this one's actually been on point, which is a
thank you, back channel.
And so some of us are on it are saying that
our first recollection, in fact, of the use of the term walled garden in the digital realm was, in fact, AOL. But the point with AOL, that usage was not a lock-in strategy, but was they were providing a walled garden because they were making the internet safe for you. It was garden versus, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting.
Streets of San Francisco.
Garden versus wild, not walled right. versus unwalled. But this was, and I think that really accords with my memory of the AOL pitch. Go out on the internet and it's just everything everywhere. Go on AOL and they've got the news, they've got the weather, they've mm-hmm. got, and it's all a nice little walled garden. The point was not the wall, it was versus the wild. Does seem like over time, though, that there's been a shift in meaning, so that one of the definitions you put up was anything that requires a username and password, which is all about the wall and nothing about the payment. And so, first of all, mm-hmm. I'm wondering whether that accords with what you're seeing, and second of all, whether there's anything made of the fact that for some reason we seem to have shifted the use of this metaphor from wild versus tame to locked versus open.
That's a really great point. And I think it's funny, one of my concluding points was going to be this kind of profound announcement that one of the frustrating things about the focus on kind of the literalism of walled gardens is that it moves our attention to the walls and away from kind of what's supposed to happen inside them or our intentions for these spaces. It's interesting. I haven't seen that discussion revisited. I've seen a few scattered comparisons of the garden to the woods, where the woods are this kind of seemingly natural ecosystem, they're self-fertilizing, their things grow wild in them, they're untamed, versus the kind of carefully manicured, curated garden. And of course, the person who, I can find you this reference if you want it, the person who is making this comparison prefers the woods. Which is funny because back in the day, the woods were scary, dark, full of wolves, predators, et cetera, et cetera. And now the meaning of the woods has also shifted in the 10 plus years.
It seems interesting that when you're talking about walled gardens, it's usually, when you're talking about the walls, you're usually talking about access, whether it's closed or whether it's open. But I think like another big purpose of the walls in real walled gardens is it's a dedication of space. As in a dedication of space to a certain type of creativity, namely gardening in real life. And I think that's exactly the role that a lot of access restrictions have now on the internet, where things are a lot more open than back when they were maybe in the AOL days, I think. Where, like, you have a forum that has passwords and certain walls, but that's really more to keep out other types of creativity so we can focus on the type of creativity that this is dedicated to.
I think that's absolutely demarcating space and kind of pointing to this area and saying, well, it's different from that area is, I mean, in some ways, the human activity, right? You know, we make meaning by making difference and making comparisons. I was really struck, actually, by this garden, this beautiful garden in East Cambridge, right near where I'm staying, that sort of has walls, but even funnier, has this completely pointless, symbolic, cute little wrought iron gate. And the gate's standing there, right, freestanding, and we just walked around it and walked in. And I had thought the gate wasn't even locked. It just existed to demarcate that space and indicate to what end it should be used. And thinking back to this garden, one of the things I asked the gardeners was whether the space had to be a garden in order to fulfill the function they had intended for it. And they said, no, actually. The garden wasn't incidental, but it also wasn't necessary. They could have gone with a mural. They could have gone with many things that indicated to the people they were trying to drive out that the space was not empty, right? That it was being used by a group of people for something that was not drug dealing, and could the drug dealers please leave? And what I think is interesting is that it worked. In this case, seemingly, and that part of how it worked, as you said, was kind of visibly categorizing spaces and letting other people know what the neighbor's expectations for that space were. And garden was kind of categorically incompatible with drug dealing in that world, and so that somehow enforced it. I mean, you're talking about creativity, and I'm talking about keeping people out again, which, again, we return to this distinction, but I think...
Everything else out. I think that's the key to the walls.
So everything else.
Well, a lot of... Well, pretty much everything that's not focused on that creativity. Otherwise, you lose your focus.
Well, we can begin to argue about permeability and transparency. So we get back to the chain link fences, which allow neighbors to see in and seeds to blow in and out.
Have you given thought, and this may be premature and out of range, but the broader issues around commons and the commons and Eleanor Ostrom's work?
That's a great and hard question. I mean, yeah. I think...
I know it's hard.
thank you for posing that great and hard question. I've done a bit of thinking about public parks, which is not the commons.
Right.
But close. And about the ways in which, if anyone's interested, I'm happy to talk about free Wi-Fi, public parks, and the kind of similar rhetorics about them.
Often at walls.
Public parks, yes, they do. And gates, and opening and closing hours. Yep. And, you know, we get back to the commons, which stands as this sort of ideal case of... Yep. A thing without walls, a thing that is equally shared. And, you know, I'm going to have to admit that I don't actually know enough about the historical commons.
It seems like you might still want to have a fence around the common to keep, you know, cattle from somewhere else from wandering into it, or keep your own from leaving it.
Yeah, exactly. That your common actually belongs to your group of people. Your common is not the common of some other strangers who wander in and decide that they'd like to graze their sheep there. Which gets us back to how you know your common is your common. You know, you could argue that the common is the common because it doesn't have walls, that in a world in which just about everything, houses have walls, everything has walls, the open spaces then become kind of...
I mean, a lot of the town commons in New England
ground.
That, you know, historically had that purpose have at least some sort of at least ceremonial chain or gate or, you know, low fence or something around them so that you go into them in certain places, and if you want to go into the other, you have to climb over that.
I mean, that's even that sort of gets back to this idea. We need to actually make room for the commons. And that means actually, you know, clearly demarcating where it begins and ends so that it doesn't get parceled out again. Who was it? I think Adana and I have been talking about the history of enclosure in Great Britain and the sort of the deep irony that enclosure represented actually the destruction of walls, the destruction of villages. So tenant farmers and their homes were removed from their homes in order to make space for the kind of large scale cultivation of land and grazing of sheep and cattle. And that ironically, the enclosures resulted in more open space, which is not the way people think about it. But then that open space, of course, came at this terrible, terrible cost. And it actually was a privatization, not a commonization, which tends to violate what we think of as open space, which we think of as being open. I mean, it's kind of like I could go on and on free associating in a sense, but you know, it's a bit like our understanding of the American West, in which there is a lot of open space, but it's also fenced in, even if the fences are just a string of chicken wire kind of held up by a post, you do have to fence them in. Fences make neighbors, period. We don't have neighbors unless we have kind of boundaries. You know, getting back to... Amar suggested that I have some questions, and one of the questions I'd had was, you know, when, if ever, are walls a good idea? I thought this group might be more anti-wall than it is, but...
I think it's pro-garden.
Certainly being against an element in the periodic table, it's not... So sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not.
As always, the answer is, it just depends.
As Frost wrote.
I'm going to guess this group, and obviously I'm... You know, pretending to speak for everybody, and I know that you couldn't possibly do, but my guess would would be that this group would have no problem at all with walls that are established to create a creative space in which, or sites that have required use, we're all on those sites, that's not a problem. But the problem is, and it's too bad Christian isn't here, but I'll look at Doc instead. Doc. Yeah. The problem becomes when it becomes close to infrastructure, which is was the old AOL play, where people through the non-competitive nature of the market have limited choices and are attracted to walled garden as a sort of basic way of getting access to the internet. So where the walls are so, they're completely non-permeable because AOL will not show you that stuff.
That's in where walled gardens are the only choice you get. You don't get a backyard. You don't get a kind of membership and volunteer or my other comparative case, which was volunteers in a public park who just donate their time to something that they don't own and cannot control.
Or vacationing presidents who oddly clear brush
yes.
turned into a tradition.
But you both talked about, you know, the walled space for creativity. I think it's terribly important that it's a walled space for security as well. And if people are secure, they also can reach out and deal with diversity and appreciate diversity. And there are lots of ironies and all of that, but it does, you know, when it's good, that's a way it's really good.
I mean, one of the things that I'm most sympathetic to is the ambivalence in the educational technology community about walled gardens. I mean, broadly understood. At this point, I think we took walled gardens and we went really wide, and then we kind of narrowed. We keep going in and out of a kind of firm definition of it. But I'm really sympathetic to the claims that students who are learning something new might well want or need a kind of protected space to learn without. Again, my boogeyman is always the 4chan people, which terrify me. Mm-hmm. You know, if I had to learn how to do anything with the eyes of the world, with the eyes of the very critical world upon me, that doesn't seem like a healthy or happy thing to yeah. ask people to do, period. On the other hand, then we get back to this, well, how much of a wall is a wall? And, you know, do we really need to be protecting people from themselves? That's a kind of difficult line to take.
There's also the issue of available materials. So in New England is laced with stone walls mm-hmm. because glaciers left lots of rocks. And if you wanted to do agriculture, you had to make walls.
Yeah.
So it's sort of self-enclosing, okay, in that respect. And then also abandoned when the Civil War came along and all the guys went off to fight and then went off to factories and it all reverted to woods. But that was available materials. But walled gardens on the net are also available materials. Like we still haven't figured out a way to do cohorts or memberships or social groups in the wild. Okay, if you're a company, you have a login and a password. This is as far as we've gotten in 15 years. It's still pretty lame, but it's the easy thing to do, right? It's available materials. Okay, I'm going to set up a place. I'm going to have to make people members in order to participate here, because that's what my geeks know how to do, and that's how we do security. What's that?
Usenet news groups don't have a login.
No, but they're
some are moderated.
But not all. You know, you can kind of move in and out. In that sense, they're more wild.
Except that they do have you being in the group or not. And that's actually one of the big things that Deja did was Deja by introducing search, said that you no longer have to be in the group to read the group. Right? You had to enter, like, alt.sex, for example, to read alt.sex messages.
I think it's worth keeping the distinction between something that overtly insists that you become a member and something that you have to type a name and
it's categorization.
But I mean, I
but I'm saying there's still some kind of conceptual walls, of boundaries of inside and outside, of being in the group or out of the group in terms of locating yourself.
I think it's really worth keeping a distinction still between. I mean, that's like saying, you know, it's not like you turn on your computer and these things just flowed by. You know, it was fairly minimal. You know, you didn't have to know it because It's not like you have to know a secret name. There's like a huge list of names that came up. You could look at something. Your presence as a reader was completely invisible. So there was no record, in, you know, conceivable record that you would, you know, I mean, they're somewhere, but it's pretty obscure, that you had read these things. So I think, yes, you could say that there was, it wasn't completely cost-free. You had to, like, go to that name. But I don't think that's, I think it's useful to make a distinction between that and something where you either have to register or you have to register and be approved by others. You know, I think, you know, I think calling everything that you do a wall starts to lose the meaning of it.
Well, except that, I mean, we take walls that we can walk through all the time. I think for me it's the difference between a wall and a locked door. Like, the password issue of, like, signing up and whatnot is basically getting a key. And that's different from walls that actually create, that actually start to contain the space. And I think what I think of Usenet is as walls that you can contain the space where it's, you know, there's no doors that lock certain people out. Whereas the idea of a password is much more of the locked door where you have to get the key.
I mean, it's the question of, you know, what's the cost of getting in and out? I'm reminded of a friend of mine who was doing studies at this knitting group online. And one of the tech support accidents, somebody had misconfigured it, and they just got left with this legacy problem, was that people had to wait a little while to become members. They had to request, and then it took a little while for some unknown sort of inefficient reason. And it turned out that that was great, that a lot of the members of this knitting society really liked it, because it meant that you had to invest a little bit in getting in. And that investment of time and the idea that there was a wait, that it was not cost-free, that there was sort of friction and impatience involved, was helped solidify their idea that you should want to be there. And so another way to think about kind of the gardens is, what's the cost of getting in and out? You know, you can often get things out of walled gardens. It's just online, digitally. It's just incredibly expensive. And the same way, you could remove your soil from a community garden plot. You would just have to get a dump truck and, you know, physically truck it out. And I know people who have talked about actually doing that. So in both cases, I like the language of at least of investment or cost, or I don't want to get too economic about this. That's not really what I mean. Maybe what I mean is labor, that there's no free lunch here, let's say, in terms of movement, and that's probably a good thing.
It's not a dichotomy. There's sort of walliness.
Yes, the walliness is not dichotomous, and we can think of it in terms of how hard it's going to be to hack your way in or pull yourself out.
Mm-hmm. One other aspect that I think, in relation to your questions, what the questions are, is that I think a lot of people experience walled gardens as nowadays digital walled gardens as a proliferation of them. And one starts to spend one's time rushing from one garden to the next and then back to the original one. And as more and more gardens proliferate, you know, sort of some fall into disuse and other new ones they add to their ever-increasing number, adding to their stress. And since I do a lot of teaching also, like, people continue to ask me amazingly, like, what is the use of walled gardens? And, you know, it's sort of like asking, like, why would people want to go in a place and dig dirt? It reflects such a complete lack of understanding of what a garden is based on a few concrete pieces of information. Anyway, those are my thoughts.
What I think is interesting, actually, that going back to the AOL example, is that the discussion about AOL was the problem of there only being one garden, and that as a disastrous sort of limitation on people's experience of what the internet could be. And I think part of the discussion about walled gardens now has moved towards the proliferation of walled gardens, of usernames and passwords and, you know, networks and this and that. And so suddenly we see this problem of interoperability being seen as a problem of walled gardens, whereas that's not the 1990s issue. Yes.
AOL was a little different from everything else, because AOL was something that existed separately from the internet and was then added to it. Although it's interesting that people I don't think react the same way when another early system that was separate from the internet and was then added to it, which was the well. Are you familiar with that?
Mm-hmm. No, I'm just enjoying that was the also, kind of mental comparison.
That was
comparison.
Also very much a walled garden. It was a totally gated community with no public access whatsoever. And then, it was attached in a loose way to the internet in somewhat the same way and the same time that AOL was. It didn't cause nearly the same kind of reaction from all the other internet users when it happened, but when we talk about walled gardens now, though, we're talking more about creating new walled gardens that are already in the internet rather than taking something that was external and attaching it.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna save that and return to that later in my head, because I think I think there's something interesting there about the way, again, things have changed since the 1990s, and we forget that, we sort of need to rehistoricize the term in a way. Yes.
I mean, one of the biggest things that's changed is that, the internet is no longer new. When people heard about the internet in the early 90s, they had, no idea, most of them, what it was, because it was completely new. So for the average person to get involved in the internet, AOL solved a lot of their problems. It was like a, introduction. So it had a unique role to play, and that you have to keep that context. I think that's a very important part of the story. That's why a walled garden at those times was a very, very pleasant place for people who were overwhelmed by, oh, how do I do this? I don't know how to configure my computer. I don't know what that is. What do you mean a URL? What's that?
I mean, we get back to this idea of experts and learning and training wheels, in a sense. Mm-hmm. So we have time for like one or two more questions.
Pass around the dessert, too, by the way. It's always sitting there. Yeah. And I should do, generally what we do is pass it around to people, so I should do that. Mm-hmm.
I was just going to add that also it's sort of hard to remember before Google, but finding stuff wasn't easy. I mean, and it was easy in CompuServe, you could find things, and in AOL, you could sort of find things even easier. Yeah, right. So I mean, there was a time when finding stuff was hard. Now we don't even think about it.
And even just knowing what to do on the internet.
There'd be nothing to do. Right.
There
wasn't
that
much stuff
there.
It seems to me that if I remember the early days of the internet, I remember Prodigy, AOL, and all of those. And in my mind, I created the metaphor that it was like KOAs versus the national park system. Mm-hmm. Now that I think about that metaphor that I came up with way back then, I think interesting thing about it is that actually even the national park system is a walled garden. It's just a freer one, a little less proprietary than the other ones.
Yeah.
And the truth of the matter is, the bottom line of being human is we're always creating spaces that we can feel safe in that are human sized. And so it's just once you get comfortable in a certain size space, well, let's take a bigger one. Because now I know how to operate some of those things that are in the bigger one. And the bottom line is that, nature wins everything. Those walls go away in a matter of years, no matter, how long, once they're no longer maintained by the humans that want to create walls.
Yes.
Yes.
The one other interesting comparison between like the walled gardens and like the openness of the wilds is that like when you look at the old maps where it said like here there be monsters and like the part of the world that isn't explored yet, I mean that's like extremely threatening, but it's also extremely like exciting that there's a lot of like unbound cool stuff out there, but that can be overwhelming. So I think that there's a place for both as long as both can exist, because you have to have the walled gardens where you feel comfortable and where you can allow a certain type of creativity to grow. But then it's also nice to know that there's other stuff